A series of gunmen rush into a bank, demanding that the tellers give them all of the money. They grow impatient, firing on the poor bank employees. They ransack the place, taking whatever they can. Patrons are left stunned at what they have just witnessed. The robbers become infamous across the city. Their leader taunts the press, swearing to kill any officers of the law that come after him. This sounds like an old-school cops and robbers story, perhaps the setup to the adventure of some costumed hero. Except, this was no fictional tale. This is the story of a real gang, a gang whose exploits may have directly inspired one of fiction's most iconic villains. Welcome to Villains, a Parcast original. I'm Alastair Murden. On this show, we look at the world's most infamous villains, both real and imagined. We aim to understand how villainy translates from history into our greatest fictional stories. You can find episodes of Villains and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Villains for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Villains in the search bar. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. This is our final episode on postmodern psychopaths. Last week, we discussed the Joker, the fictional embodiment of chaos. Today, we'll examine the real-world philosophy that represents his brand of evil, anarchy. We'll look at examples of people who, like the Joker, have had their proverbial one bad day and turned to violence as a way out of their oppressive lives. As we'll soon see, there is no perfect analogue to the Joker in the real world. On a surface level, no criminal has had such a long and murderous career. He changes his methods and his motives every decade as the times change with him. But as we discussed last episode, he always represents chaos, the impulse to try and tear society down rather than work to improve it. Anarchy is the closest real-world equivalent to that philosophy. It's more nuanced than that. Many of its earliest practitioners were actually social activists. But it quickly devolved into murder and mayhem. Heath Ledger's Joker explicitly adheres to this system of belief. In The Dark Knight, he says, "Introduce a little anarchy, upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos." We can safely brand him a villain because he actually knows that anarchy will lead to chaos. He expects this and is working toward it. In mid to late 19th century France, where anarchy has its roots, many anarchists legitimately hoped for a better tomorrow. But they consistently lacked a plan for what was to come after they disrupted the established order. Their dream failed because they had no answer to the question of how to structure a society. To better understand this phenomenon, we'll look at the case of Octave Garnier and the Bonneau Gang. They were a group of anarchists in Paris in 1911 who started with good intentions. But in a very short amount of time, they completely transformed into murderous villains. Their philosophy of anarchy led them to nihilism and chaos. They were a product of a tumultuous society. But first, we'll see that there's actually a direct connection between these French rebels and the Joker himself. This line of French idealism fed directly into the creation of fiction's most notorious villain. The most common source of inspiration referenced by the Joker's creators was the image of Conrad Veidt in the 1928 silent film The Man Who Laughs, based on the Victor Hugo novel. Veidt's character has a pale white face, slicked back hair, and a wide, disturbing grin that's almost inhuman. In fact, one might assume that this was some sort of cosplay of the Joker if they didn't know that it actually predates the character by 12 years. The film tells the story of the titular man, Gwynplaine. He was the son of a nobleman who was brutally disfigured as a way of slighting his father. This was based on an actual punishment employed in 19th century Europe. In many ways, it was similar to the Glasgow smile that was used for Heath Ledger's version of the Joker. The more modern Glasgow smile became a favorite method of torture in the 1920s and 30s among various gangs. It involved taking a knife or other sharp object and cutting the victim from the corners of their mouths to their ear. They were then beaten severely, so as they screamed, they made the wound even worse. But clearly, it was being used without the catchy name as early as the 1600s, when Hugo's novel is set. In any case, we can see how someone who bears this scar is usually a victim, not a villain like Ledger's Joker. Such is the case with Gwynplaine. In fact, he is entirely sympathetic. He is forced to flee his home and find work as a circus performer. One of the most tragic lines of the film occurs when a fellow clown sees him and says, "What a lucky clown you are. You don't have to wipe off your laugh." Many interpretations of the Joker feel rooted in this sort of tragic irony. While Gwynplaine makes the best of his situation, the Joker collapses at the horrid realization that his face has been contorted into a permanent smile. In the 1989 Batman film, Jack Nicholson's Joker seems to try and cover this up with makeup. That film seems to have taken the Joker's Man Who Laughs origins to heart. Director Tim Burton employed a lot of high-contrast lighting and exaggerated gothic sets that recall the chiaroscuro style of the 1928 film. The Man Who Laughs was actually the epitome of that style. But what does this tell us about the real-world villains that might have inspired the Joker? Well, as I've said, The Man Who Laughs was based on an earlier novel by French author Victor Hugo. He published the story in 1869, using it to criticize the elite class of his time. Even though the story takes place in 17th century England, the social injustices being described were similar to what people faced in 19th century France. By putting some distance in terms of place and time between the story and his own society, Hugo could make its readers more open to its message. Gwynplaine is sold to a band of wanderers who disfigure children by King James II, a ruler who was known for brutally maiming and executing his enemies. He was also disliked for having forced his Catholicism on the people. This was reminiscent of France's own struggles against tyrants. The history of French government in the 18th and 19th centuries was full of constant upheaval. It began with the First Revolution all the way back in 1789, when overtaxed and starving peasants threw off the yoke of monarchy and formed the first French Republic. They only had to behead a few thousand nobles to do it. In this case, the lower classes also seem rather villainous. Of course, that government eventually fell to Napoleon Bonaparte's dictatorship, which in turn gave way to a second republic, which in turn fell to another dictatorship under the leadership of Napoleon's nephew in 1852. It was that government that Hugo was most directly criticizing with The Man Who Laughs. He was drawing a clear comparison between the disliked James II and the upstart Napoleon III. He hated to see that the people had once again lost the ability to choose their own leader. He knew that such a man was driven by ego and would only lead his people into war and starvation. In fact, Hugo disliked Napoleon so much that he went into exile on an island, which at that point was pretty much the go-to response to your political party losing power. The hero of Gwynplaine rises from the depths of poverty to the halls of nobility, and as such, has the opportunity to show the lords of England how their machinations have affected his life and the lives of others. What for them are easy decisions made on paper led to real suffering, to misery. He is the tragic clown, like the Joker. But he takes the opposite tactic. He uses his tragedy to motivate change rather than to tear society down. As we'll soon see, there were real French anarchists who split along these lines. Some would try and change the world for the better, while others just sowed chaos for their own gain. We can glean two things from this history of rebellion and conquest. For one, it is an excellent real-world example of the struggle between chaos and order that the Joker and Batman represent. Despite decades of victory and defeat, despite countless instances of almost achieving the balance of a free society but falling short, patriots like Hugo continued to try, continued to hope for a better world. The second thing we can glean from this history, however, is less positive. It shows us that, for some French citizens, government became a bad word. The idea of any kind of peaceful society to them seemed like a joke. Unsurprisingly, while some French citizens remained servants of order, others became agents of chaos. In 1848, a form of government that would become synonymous with chaos began to take shape. Anarchy. Next, we'll explore the beginnings of anarchy and the individuals that took it to murderous extremes. Now, back to the story. In our hunt for real-life villains that share similarities with the Joker, we find that French anarchism is a good jumping-off point. Those who followed it tended to be disillusioned radicals who had given up on social order, just like the Clown Prince. Reporter Ishan Theroux writes that anarchism began as early as 1848, when French politician Pierre-Joseph Proudhon said, "Whoever lays his hand on me to govern me is a usurper and tyrant, and I declare him my enemy." But Theroux also notes that Proudhon was not advocating for the type of lawlessness we associate with anarchy today. His anarchism was anti-government, in that it was anti-trust, anti-anything that furthered the exploitation of the working class and perpetuated class privilege. He actually believed in instituting various social programs that we could consider left-leaning or socialist policies. Once again, discussing French politics becomes complicated when we try to place labels on different factions and belief systems. These early anarchists were trying to pursue a lack of government, but to them, that meant the people governing themselves. Only later would French anarchists begin to advocate for no government at all, resembling what we today might call a libertarian, more conservative point of view. But that too is an imperfect comparison, as the anarchists were rebelling against a wealthy, capitalistic upper class that we would also consider conservative. Basically, this was a faction with no one unifying principle. Like the Joker, their methods and motives changed depending on the decade. In 1871, their chaotic point of view would shake Paris to its core. New Yorker staff writer Adam Gopnik writes that the previous year, in 1870, the aforementioned Napoleon III met with a catastrophic failure. A war with Prussia ended in defeat, and he was forced to surrender and flee to England. It was a sort of early rehearsal for World War I, with the Prussians gaining wealth, land, and the confidence to maybe try this again someday. In February 1871, in Paris, certain radical elements feared the return of dictatorship. So they violently removed the remaining members of the French army and declared independence. With no clear plan for governance, they instead went about looting and destroying the homes of their enemies. They even toppled a statue of Napoleon. When the French army returned in May, a bloody and fiery battle ensued. Tens of thousands died, and rather than see the city retaken, some of the radicalists set fire to various buildings. We can't help but think of how Alfred, Batman's butler, describes the Joker in The Dark Knight. Some men just want to watch the world burn. French politics are complicated. The radicalists were extreme, though not exactly murderous jokers. Similarly, the new French government that followed was hardly a perfect, noble Batman analogue. But again, we can see the wheels of chaos and order grinding against each other. The lower classes of the 19th century were born into a chaotic world full of war, disease, and death. They were then forced into capitalist systems that promised to save them, but instead forced them into hard labor that paid and fed them too little. Even worse, the increasing media attention led to a public awareness of how the other half lived. They knew that some people had completely mastered chaos. They lived in mansions and palaces, while others starved. The anarchists throughout the world were only made more desperate in the decades that followed. In March 1881, a revolutionary group known as the People's Will assassinated the Russian Tsar Alexander II. This led to his less progressive son taking power and preventing reform. Then, in 1898, Italian King Umberto I ordered the massacre of some of his own subjects in Milan. They were protesting food shortages. This was enough of a one bad day for Italian-American anarchist Gaetano Bresci, who, in July 1900, shot Umberto dead. Finally, in September 1901, Polish-American steelworker Leon Frank Czolgosz shot American President William McKinley. The president eventually died from his wound. Czolgosz said, "I don't believe in the Republican form of government, and I don't believe we should have any rulers. It is right to kill them." This rapid-fire succession of global assassinations calls to mind the Joker's original murder spree in Batman No. 1. In that comic, he calls out multiple wealthy jewel owners, telling them all that they will die and he will steal their valuables. There is seemingly no escape for them. No matter what Batman or the police do, the Joker succeeds in killing his victims. This is also echoed in The Dark Knight, when the Joker rapidly kills three major law enforcement officials despite police protection. Whether in comic books or films, the Joker's targets are always representative of the social order, people who adhere to and lead various organizations. In the comic books, it was capitalist businessmen. In World War II-era America, capitalism wasn't questioned, and these men were seen as the heroes who were fueling the war effort with their industry. By killing them, the Joker pointed out that they weren't heroes to everyone. They still oppressed and exploited their workers, as did the targets of the anarchist assassinations in the real world. Joker's targets in the film, mainly law enforcement officials, are similarly controversial in the modern day. While some see them as heroes who protect and serve, some feel they have overstepped their boundaries and instead oppress the people rather than serve them. In all cases, none escape the murderous machinations of the Joker. Similarly, there was no escape for those world leaders from the global anarchist movement. King Umberto, in particular, was shot at on two other occasions before Bresci finally came along and finished the job. In the real-world cases, the assassinations were generally sympathetic. They were oppressed workers who were expected to allow themselves to continue to be exploited by economic systems that made them barely better than slaves. but by embracing chaos, by turning to murder, they only hurt the cause of the working class. We mentioned how in Russia, the next Tsar was even more oppressive. In Italy, this assassination galvanized sentiment amongst more left-leaning parties and helped fascist rule to take hold in 1922. And in the United States, capitalist robber barons were allowed to continue to force their workers into terrible conditions. Chaos only bred more chaos. We see how taking the easy way out, resorting to violence and murder, turns individuals into the villains they sought to destroy. If they had a plan, if they had attempted more intelligent methods of change, they might have been hailed as heroes. Back in France, at the dawn of the 20th century, a movement known as illegalism was taking shape. This was a sub-movement with anarchism that embraced criminal activity as the best way to challenge the dominant political system. In some cases, it had mildly positive results. Writer Doug Imrie suggests that in the early 1900s, young anarchist Marius Jacob formed a criminal ring that stole from the rich and gave the proceeds to the poor. A turn-of-the-century Robin Hood, and perhaps a sort of distorted French Batman. But there was an opposite side to this coin. France was full of disillusioned young men who, like the various assassins before them, were prepared to commit violence for violence's sake. Enter Octave Garnier. As a young man of 17, he was unsatisfied with life as a butcher. He turned to theft, and shortly thereafter, he was caught and sent to jail for 3 months. This was his one bad day. According to writer Doug Imrie, prisons in France at this time were basically death camps. They were entirely for profit. Every prisoner had a job and even received a salary. They could use this to buy food, though most of it was put into a savings account. If a prisoner could not be productive, could not adhere to a schedule, then they might starve. That is, if they weren't first identified as an enemy of the state and dragged off for execution. Garnier was young, naive, handsome. This was not a good place for him to be. Even being there for only 3 months likely exposed him to horrors that were previously unimaginable. It would permanently change his way of thinking and send him off on a dangerous course. He was further embittered by the fact that one of his fellow thieves was given a suspended sentence. He wrote, "Through this, I understood the meaning of justice." It was a true supervillain origin if we've ever seen one. During his prison stay, Garnier was first introduced to anarchist ideals. He left prison fully radicalized, though he may have still hoped for a peaceful life at this point. He wrote, "I came to understand anarchists and became a fervent partisan of them, not because these theories gave me any particular pleasure, but because I found them to be the most fair and open to discussion." But his actions would soon speak louder than his words. In 1910, living in Belgium to avoid the draft, he came into contact with fellow anarchists and illegalists, and soon they began to act out their philosophy by robbing the homes of wealthy Parisians. They believed they were disrupting the social order by taking from the rich. Then, in 1911, a fateful meeting occurred as Garnier first came into contact with Jules Bonneau. Jules was also an anarchist. Only he had a violent streak. According to writer Paul Williams, he was fired from his last job for assaulting his boss. Together, Jules and Garnier galvanized their group into a full-on gang. Garnier wrote, "If the workers have, logically, the right to take back, even by force, the wealth that is stolen from them, and to defend, even by crime, the life that some want to tear away from them, then the isolated individual must have the same rights." he felt that any crime was justified as long as it struck out against the oppressive nature of society. As long as it sowed chaos. It was time for him to put his first Joker-esque scheme into action. In December 1911, the gang set out to rob the Société Générale Bank in Paris. The bank, still in operation today, provides a thorough account of the event. At 8:40 a.m., a man named Ernest Caby was carrying several bags of cash from the bank's headquarters. He had the cash handcuffed to his person. His friend, Alfred Piment, was accompanying him. They tried to hurry as the weather was bad. It was raining heavily. This perhaps made them less aware of the two grim figures approaching them from the front of the bank. Suddenly, a shot rang out. Ernest grabbed his neck in shock. Blood squirted forth from a bullet hole in his throat. He fell to the ground as Alfred ran for the safety of the bank. One of the men stood over Ernest, glaring down at him, gun still drawn. He fired again. The shot punctured Ernest's lung and thoroughly disabled him. Coldly, the man bent down and used a knife to free the bags of cash from Ernest's person. An automobile pulled up to the bank. This was a surprise. Cars still weren't exactly common in 1911. The two men piled inside with the bags of money, then sped away into the rain. The members of the Bonneau gang were thrilled at their success. Jules' idea to steal a car for the heist was rather inspired. In fact, it was the first time criminals had used a getaway car in recorded history. This gave the group a certain air of cleverness, of perhaps even being criminal masterminds. They had tens of thousands of francs, and they would soon accrue more. It didn't occur to them that their blind pursuit of money was the exact thing they were fighting against. And it didn't bother them that they had grievously injured both the person they had stolen the car from and Ernest at the bank. He would miraculously survive, but it would not be long before the gang took the lives of other victims. They were rapidly moving away from their ideology and descending into total chaos. Next, we'll hear about the rest of the gang's crime spree and learn of their ultimate fate. And now, back to the story. In December 1911, the Bonneau gang committed their first big public crime by robbing a bank in Paris. They got away with thousands of francs and grievously injured a bank worker. Though they ostensibly had started their gang out of a shared belief in creating a freer society, they now seemed only interested in increasing their own personal fame and wealth. Octave Garnier, who had previously seemed at least somewhat thoughtful in his writings, now seemed to be the most diabolical of all. He showed no signs of remorse for the injuries he had caused to innocent people. He wrote, "Why kill workers? They are vile slaves. Without them, there wouldn't be the bourgeois and the rich." He was either deluding himself and trying to assuage his guilt, or he was revealing himself to be a psychopath in the mold of the Joker. In our last episode, we talked about the four-factor model of psychopathy that helped us to identify the Joker as a psychopath. We looked at how a psychopath manipulates, feels no empathy, leads an impulsive lifestyle, and engages in criminal behavior. Garnier had manipulated his friends into becoming a deadly gang. He was now showing no signs of empathy for other human beings. His entire existence was impulsive, living from crime to crime. And naturally, his behavior was exclusively criminal. Though his lifetime predates postmodern thought, his writing indicates the beginnings of that kind of grey area thinking. He was suggesting that a horrible act, murder, was justified in that it brought down a worse system. Of course, this was terribly misguided. His actions were doing little to fight the oppression of the working class. Like the Joker, he was taking the easy way out. Rather than try and promote a new, better order through self-sacrifice, he was masking his own hate and greed as a rebellion against the system. And so, we can invite Octave Garnier into the ranks of our postmodern psychopaths, making him the final one of this season. The remainder of his criminal career only became more intense from this point on. Throughout the early months of 1912, the gang terrorized Paris. Most ruthlessly, they entered the home of one Louis-Hippolyte Moreau, killing him and his maid and stealing 30,000 in francs. Writer Paul Williams claims that Jules Bonneau became especially bold around this time, roughly February 1912. After he killed two police officers, he then went to the offices of Le Petit Parisien. This newspaper was considered a mouthpiece for the upper class. Waving around a pistol, Jules said, "We'll burn off our last round against the cops, and if they don't care to come, we'll certainly know how to find them." It seems he truly thought they were unstoppable, that they would bring down the established social order. In this way, they were perhaps just as delusional as the Joker. No different than a supervillain monologuing at their arch-enemy. Société Générale reports that a different branch of the bank was hit in March 1912. Jules, Garnier, and the rest of the gang stormed the building. One bookkeeper was hit in the chest and played dead. His colleague was also hit and sadly crawled a few feet before being sprayed with more bullets. The excited gang members hopped the counter, anxiously trying to open the vault. They were like the Joker's gang from the beginning of The Dark Knight, showing no remorse over the people they killed to get their payday. They were again successful, getting away with thousands of francs. But the public was now thoroughly scandalized. They called for someone to put an end to these killers. Even though there was no Batman to bring them to justice, there was a slowly encroaching police force. Theatrically named the Tiger Brigade, they interrogated various sources until they were able to track Jules to an apartment on April 24, 1912. Even so, he proved as tenacious a villain as ever. He killed the vice chief of police and then ran across the rooftops in a scene that recalls Batman and the Joker's first showdown in Batman No. 1. But this was a short-lived escape. Just 4 days later, he was tracked to Choisy-le-Roi and was supposedly surrounded by 500 police officers. This was only inevitable. Again, the Bonneau gang had been delusional to think that they could truly overcome an entire government. There were at most a dozen of them at the height of their career. Like many radicals, their victories were few and swift, and their defeat was even swifter. Jules was shot 10 times as the police stormed his safe house. He somehow managed to survive the night, but finally perished at a hospital the following morning. Octave Garnier, a poor young butcher who had once been an idealist, now knew that his days were numbered. However, his friend Victor Sergei wrote that he went out somewhat more spectacularly than Jules. Also holed up in a safe house, he fought off multiple waves of law enforcement in a massive shootout. He was so entrenched that his enemies had to resort to dynamite. This was what finally did him in. With nowhere to go, he decided not to let his enemies have the final say. If nothing else, he would remain free until the end. He turned his pistol on himself. Though initially sympathetic, the members of the Bonneau gang were nothing more than petty murderers at the time of their deaths. They had allowed their hate and their disillusionment to turn them into the villains they sought to overthrow. They were the opposite of Marius Jacob, the Robin Hood-esque figure we mentioned earlier. He was captured and served 20 years in jail. Upon his release, he lived a peaceful life. Toward the end, he said, "I don't think that illegalism can free the individual in present-day society. If he manages to free himself of a few constraints using this means, the unequal nature of the struggle will create others that are even worse and, in the end, will lead to the loss of his freedom, the little freedom he had, and sometimes his life." We cannot claim a direct connection between these turn-of-the-century anarchists and the Joker, but there is a certain thematic through-line that is fairly compelling. The disillusioned young men of the Bonneau gang were a part of the same disenfranchised lower class that Victor Hugo had been writing about since the mid-19th century. The hero of his novel, The Man Who Laughs, Gwynplaine, was a similar figure, only on a different side of the coin. He chose to overcome adversity and advocate on behalf of the people. He chose the productive path rather than the chaotic one. When Batman co-creators Bob Kane, Bill Finger, and Jerry Robinson used the movie version of the character as inspiration for the Joker, they were either consciously or unconsciously channeling years of anarchist conflict. Years of young men who refused to live by the established system and either rebelled peacefully or turned to violence. That disillusioned attitude can be seen in the modern internet trolls we discussed last episode. Over 100 years later, the chaotic clown archetype appeals to the same sort of person. We might even go so far as to suggest that there has always been a certain French quality to the Joker. Maybe it's his painted white face that reminds us of a Revolution-era nobleman, or his three-piece suit and playful manner that's reminiscent of the cabarets of the late 19th century. Regardless, we think he is the natural inheritor of the anarchist message. That's not to say he isn't also distinctly American. As we discussed last episode, the Joker existed within a tradition of comic book mobsters. These were the American equivalent to anarchists, trying to take their slice of the American dream that had been denied them. The Joker also resembles Bugsy Siegel, the Nevada mobster who was just as glamorous as he was homicidal. His girlfriend, Virginia Hill, was just as adept a criminal. Their relationship reminds us of the relationship between the Joker and Harley Quinn, his psychiatrist-turned-homicidal girlfriend. We've hardly been able to touch upon that extremely popular villainess. However, if you stick around for our next season, you might just find that we discuss her in depth. But first, we have to wrap up our discussion of postmodern psychopaths. As we've seen, the ambiguity central to postmodern thought causes us to question ideals that we once held up as good or actions that we once considered evil. Anton Chigurh represented the shared psychosis of Vietnam. Villanelle, the millennia-old fear that men have of women. Norman Bates, the fears of gender lines blurring. Alex Delage makes us question the ethics of justice. And Kaiser Soze leads us to consider the ambiguity of the truth. But the Joker reigns supreme in this regard, as his 80-year history has allowed him to change with every decade, reflecting our society back at itself. We make him darker and darker with each new adaptation, essentially mirroring how our own real-world fears become more and more intimidating. We're reassured as we see how Batman can defeat even the most vile versions of the Joker. But as we've seen in today's episode, the Joker is also a figure who represents the oppressed, the disillusioned, those who have been broken to the point where they consider violence as the only way out. We are reminded that even if it is too late for some of these criminals, we should strive for a society that does not produce them in the first place. Which points towards a larger theme when discussing these psychopaths, both real and fictional. Psychopath is essentially a dismissive label. It is not even a real medical diagnosis. It's simply society's way of saying that a person is unhinged, vile, wrong. And that's not necessarily incorrect when we discuss someone like Ed Gein or Salter Chicka. But this too is an easy way out. Because it puts the onus entirely on the criminal, it keeps us from having to question why that psychopath was made, or why their actions make us so uncomfortable. With the killer women from our Villanelle episode, they were dismissed as aberrations, so the patriarchal societies that gave rise to them didn't have to examine how they treat females. In the case of Ed Gein, no one wanted to take responsibility for the mentally stunted, shunned neighbor that they had all ignored. On the fiction side of things, it was easier for the audiences of the 1960s to dismiss the gender-bending Norman Bates as insane, rather than consider that maybe gender isn't as well defined as we thought. It was easier for that same film audience to dismiss Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange as obscene and violence-provoking, rather than to consider that it portrayed a future that was already unfolding all around them. In each decade, across multiple mediums, our fictional postmodern psychopaths made audiences uncomfortable as they presented them with ambiguous decisions about the nature of good and evil. We hope that these questions inform how you live your own life, and that they encourage you to never give up on the pursuit of a society that works well for all its citizens, not just some. Looking toward our next season, we find that there were certain individuals in North America throughout the 20th century that exemplified those whose society had left behind. Because of their class, sex, or ethnicity, the supposed American dream was not obtainable. And so, they decided to take it for themselves. They wouldn't be stopped, no matter who stood in their way. They became the infamous mafiosos and narcos of the New World. Gangsters, the topic of our second season of Villains. Next week, we'll be starting with an iconic American movie villain, the Godfather himself. Join us as we discuss how Don Corleone's pursuit of the American dream leads him from his roots as a humble family man to a killer and a thief. Like all good villains, we love him as much as we hate him. Thanks for listening to Villains. We'll be back next Friday with a new episode. You can find all episodes of Villains and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Villains, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Villains on Spotify, just open the app and type Villains in the search bar. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. I'll see you next time. Villains was created by Drew Cole and Max Cutler. Villains is a Parcast Studios original and is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound designed by Russell Nash, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, Travis Clark, and Paul Marler. This episode of Villains was written by Greg Castro, with writing assistance by Drew Cole. I'm Alastair Murden.